This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. I'm joined by Dahlia Gabriel, fresh from your birthday, I believe. Was that yesterday?
Yeah, birthday. It's the day before the spring equinox, which I take very symbolically. But yeah, I had an amazing birthday. It was just took a day off, chilled out, ate some nice food. It was lovely. I feel very loved.
Gorgeous. Well, happy birthday to you from myself. And if I dare do this from our audience as well, can I speak for you tonight? Coming up later on the show, a certain Israeli spokesperson has been suspended. You're not going to feel upset about this one. Irish Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has, in a very surprising move, resigned. People didn't see it coming. And Al Jazeera have released their documentary about October the 7th. Very impressive investigation. We'll show you some clips from that first story. The Shifa Hospital in Gaza City has been under siege by Israeli forces for 3 days. Shelling and gunfire have been reported in the streets around the medical complex, and yet scores of people have been forcibly discharged from the hospital and told to make their way to the south of the strip. Now, of course, it's unclear how the elderly and children who are suffering the worst effects of food deprivation will be able to comply with those instructions. The IDF say they've killed 90 people in the hospital complex over the last 3 days. They also claim to have taken 160 people away for questioning, though we don't know to where. 300 others have been questioned on the hospital site. Now, as you can imagine, the IDF say that the people killed are terrorists and those questioned or arrested are suspects. But the director of Gaza's media office has rejected those terms, saying the dead and wounded were patients or displaced people. And they added, this, the Israeli occupation army practices lying and deception in spreading its narrative as part of justifying its continuous and law-breaking crimes, which violate international law, international humanitarian law. One eyewitness to the raid supported the media director's claim. Speaking to Al Jazeera, Salah Abu Sakran said this, we were in one of the buildings inside the Al-Shifa medical complex. The soldiers fired at the building where we are. They asked us to take off our clothes and go down to the hospital yard and sat us inside a residential building next to the hospital where we were interrogated. Abu Sakran said he was ordered to leave the hospital the following day and says he remains uncertain of the fate of the other detainees. This siege marks the fourth time that Al-Shifa has come under Israeli attack. And according to the World Health Organization, the most recent assault on the hospital is part of a wider pattern of Israeli contempt for international law. This morning, they published this. Since the 7th of October, the World Health Organization has documented 410 attacks on healthcare in the Gaza Strip. Attacks have resulted in 685 fatalities, 902 injuries, damage to 99 facilities, and affected 104 ambulances. Two-fifths of attacks were in Gaza City, a quarter in North Gaza, and over a quarter in Khan Yunis. They say healthcare is not a target or should not be a target. And they call for the respect of international law and active protection of civilians and healthcare. At the UN, doctors who worked in Gazan hospitals have been giving their testimony. British cancer surgeon Nick Maynard volunteered with medical aid for Palestinians. He gave this account of his time in Al-Aqsa Hospital.
I saw things at Al-Aqsa Hospital which I still wake up at night thinking about. Appalling injuries in particularly women and children, the most devastating burns in small children. One child that I'll never forget had burns so bad you could see her facial bones. We knew there was no chance of her surviving that, but there was no morphine to give her. So not only was she inevitably going to die, but she would die in agony. And what made it even worse, that there was nowhere for her to go and die. So she was just left on the floor of the emergency department to die.
Pediatrician Amber Alayan of Médecins Sans Frontières gave this description of the conditions inside the besieged hospitals.
The hospitals rely on quota systems for how many drugs they keep in their pharmacies and their stocks in each department. And they have to choose between whether do I fully stock my operating theater, my ICU, or my emergency room. And this is where you have doctors faced with horrific decisions of having to intubate and amputate children and adults without anesthetics in emergency rooms. Part of the reason for this is the lack of medications or the lack of medications accessible at that time. Part of the reason is that we have internally displaced people living in hospitals, sheltering in hospitals because they have nowhere safe to go. And what that means is they are staying in hospital beds. So what does that mean for injured people? They arrive, they get a quick and dirty surgery in an emergency room or in an operating theater, and they have nowhere to be hospitalized afterward. Or when they are lost all throughout the hospital, and our teams spend all day searching for the patient that they just operated on 12 hours before. What does this mean over the long run? The longer this war goes on, the longer these wounds have to rot. And I mean really rot. The infections are getting worse and worse, and it's horrific. It's horrific for our providers, and it's absolutely horrific for these patients.
It's really hard not to sort of have a physical reaction to hearing about sort of people's where they've had surgery rotting, you know, living flesh rotting. It's just really unimaginably appalling. The description of post-surgical complications has been made all too real by the release of footage of a young girl at Al Shifa. And we should warn you, the video depicts graphic injury, though we have blurred it to some degree. Saja Janaid is a four-year-old girl who was burned by a bomb blast in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. According to reports, she was first treated in the Al-Shifa hospital, but after Israel's attack, her father was forced to take her unmedicated for pain to the Al-Aqsa hospital in Deir al-Balah. That's a distance of 10 miles. The weapons that did that to the girl, and which have killed more than 13,000 other children, are largely supplied or funded by Western governments. And for most of the West, like the US, UK and Germany, the war on Gaza has done little to change their policies. There are exceptions, though. Last night, Canada's House of Commons passed a resolution banning arms sales to Israel. Canada joins countries like Spain and Belgium, who have introduced similar suspensions. And while Canada's resolution is non-binding, the country's foreign minister has confirmed that it will halt all future exports of weapons to Israel. Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, responded to the ban by posting this. It's regrettable that the Canadian government is taking a step that undermines Israel's right to self-defense against Hamas terrorists who have committed terrible crimes against humanity and against Israeli civilians, including the elderly, women and children. History will judge Canada's current action harshly. Israel will continue to fight until Hamas is destroyed and all hostages are returned home. Israel may not like Canada's decision, but it will be encouraging to activists in the UK demanding the same of our government. Arms manufacturers in England and Scotland have today been blocked by hundreds of trade unionists protesting for a free Palestine. The actions have shut down GE Aviation Systems in Cheltenham and Leonardo UK in Edinburgh, companies that provide components for the F-35 stealth bombers currently being used in Gaza. The protesters are calling for an end to the British supply of arms to Israel. Israel says that its continued bombing of Gaza is necessary to rid the territory of Hamas, but many suspect Benjamin Netanyahu's true plan is to rid the Strip of all Palestinians. And on that front, there is some news today. Remember this from 2 weeks ago. It's Joe Biden's announcement in Congress.
Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters.
That was Biden's plan for a floating pier, supposedly to allow the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza. But it's now being reported that in a private meeting of the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Security Committee, Netanyahu suggested a different use for it. Now, a journalist from Israeli station Cannes News reported this. Netanyahu in the Foreign Affairs Committee: "We are looking into how to distribute the aid in Gaza through non-local entities because Hamas failed the attempts to distribute it through local entities. Private companies are also being investigated. As far as the state of Israel is concerned, there is no obstacle for the Gazans to leave. Maybe even the port they are building could be used for this, but there are no countries in the world that are ready to receive them." So we already said it was a bit ridiculous, this idea of building a floating port to get humanitarian aid into Gaza. Of course, there are many ways to get humanitarian aid into Gaza without building a port. You just have to put some pressure on Israel to stop holding up the trucks. But now Netanyahu suggested, well, maybe this floating port could, instead of being used to bring humanitarian aid into Gaza, maybe it could be used for the Gazans to leave. And the conditions created by Israel in Gaza are, of course, horrendous. Injury and death are everywhere. And when a person is injured, the chance of medical treatment is slim. Meanwhile, the whole of Gaza is now on the verge of famine. Now, those are precisely the conditions that are likely to make people desperate to leave, if only they were given a route out. And someone who wants the Palestinians in Gaza to be given that route is Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
What I would do right now if I was Israel is I would try to say, number one, you want to get as many civilians out of Rafah as possible. I think that you want to try to clear that out. I know that with diplomacy, maybe you get them into Egypt. I know that that's been refused, but with the right diplomacy, I think it would be possible. But in addition to that, the thing that that I would try to do if I was Israel right now is I would just bulldoze something in the Negev. I would try to move people in there. I know that won't be the popular thing to do, but I think that that's a better option to do so that you can go in and finish the job.
That interview took place at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government in February, but it's recently surfaced online, or resurfaced online, I should say. During the last Trump presidency, Kushner was a foreign policy advisor put in charge of brokering peace between Israel and Palestine, or at least that's what they said he was trying to do, was really trying to give Israel complete hegemony in the region. And of course, if Trump is re-elected in November, Kushner could well have that job again. And what he's advocating for there is a crime against humanity. More than two-thirds of Gaza's population is now in Rafah, and forcing them into some patch of the Negev desert would very likely constitute ethnic cleansing. Later in the interview, Kushner gave his view on that suggestion.
There are real fears on the part of Arabs, and I'm sure you talk to a lot of them, who think once Gazans leave Gaza, Netanyahu's never going to let them back in.
Maybe, but I'm not sure there's much left of Gaza at this point. So, you know, if you think about even the construct, like, you know, Gaza was not really a historical precedent, right? It was the result of a war, right? You had tribes that were in different places, but then Gaza became a thing. Egypt, you know, used to run it. And then, you know, over time, you had different governments that came in different ways. So you have another war. You know, usually when wars happen, you know, borders are changed historically over time. And so my sense is I would say, how do we deal with the terror threat that is there so that it cannot be a threat to Israel or to Egypt, right? I think that both sides are spending a fortune on military. I think neither side really wants to have, you know, a terrorist organization enclaved right between them. And Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up, you know, livelihoods. You think about all the money that's gone into this tunnel network and into all the munitions, if that would have gone into education or innovation, what could have been done? And so I think that it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there. But I think from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up.
Move the people out, then clean it up. Now, I mean, if you were going to have a sort of dictionary definition of ethnic cleansing, that sounds a lot like it, right? Moving a people out and cleaning an area up. Ethnic cleansing, right? It's worth remembering that Kushner's job before he entered politics was real estate investment. Something else I learned today is that Kushner and Netanyahu were family friends back in the 1990s. So this is from an FT article. Netanyahu cultivated relationships that yielded fruit decades later. In the 1990s, a teenage Jared Kushner lent Netanyahu, they say a family friend, his bed in New Jersey. Right, so these are people who go way back, Kushner and Netanyahu, very tight. And now you've got Kushner saying, oh, get the people out, clean up the area. Oh, you could have some real nice real estate investment on that coast. Dahlia, what do you make of that from Jared Kushner?
I mean, we have to understand that there is a direct historical line between the image of Cecil Rhodes sitting in Oxford, carving up a map of southern Africa into Rhodesia, and the way that Jared Kushner is speaking about the sovereignty of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. I mean, you have to understand the level of racism and colonial thinking that has to be normalized in order for us to, in order for a man, you know, sitting in the US to believe that he should have the right over the movements and sovereignty of people that have inhabited a land for thousands of years. I mean, you have to understand that so much colonial and racist indoctrination has had to happen historically for us to get to a moment where that looks like a sane or normal thing to have happen. But I guess, you know, he is speaking from the location of another settler colonial state. So I guess that logic is kind of inbuilt in there. But I think as well, I mean, as you said, there is, it's a textbook description of ethnic cleansing, especially when you get into language like cleaning the strip up. I mean, what are you cleaning it up of? You're cleaning it up of the people who live there and who have made Gaza their home for generations. And you're talking about them as if they're dirt that you need to clean up. I mean, it's the dehumanization, the dehumanizing language, the arrogance, the colonial racist ideology that underpins what, you know, looks like an extremely kind of sanitized, suited and booted interview. It beggars belief that this is a point where this is the point we've come to where something like that looks normal and legitimate. But when it comes to, you know, these latest developments with the protesters shutting down arms factories in Britain, you know, to kind of go to the other level, the other side of this, you know, I'm extremely proud of all of those people in this country who went and shut down those factories today, because what we need to remember and what is what the likes of Jared Kushner and Netanyahu, et cetera, are trying to gloss over is the fact that this was a state who has very, very recently been found by the ICJ to be plausibly committing genocide. And under that rubric, the idea that states like Britain are still providing ammunition and still providing weapons and parts to make weapons when a country is in a state where it is considered to be plausibly committing genocide by the highest court in the land, we have to remember that that is quite a concrete violation of the 1949 Geneva Convention. We've had experts from the UN coming together and not only saying that arms exports need to be halted because to provide arms to Israel in this moment would be to violate international law, because regardless of intention or regardless of certainty, individuals or states that are supplying weapons or parts of weapons to a country that is known to be, or is at least heavily suspected to be, committing war crimes, of which genocide is one of the highest levels, are liable for aiding and abetting war crimes. And the contrast between people like Jared Kushner, people who are closely proximate to state power, who portray themselves as the defenders of law and order, are being that, you know, the people who went and protested are showing those people up to, and they have more moral courage and they have more respect for international law than any of those members of state, including, you know, Jared Kushner, who formerly was involved in quite a high position in the US government. And if Trump gets elected again, will also again return to having a high position in government. And yet the irony is that those very governments will turn around and call people who are taking direct action to stop international law being broken, they will turn around and call them the criminals, or them, you know, all sorts of terms. So I think, you know, the moral high ground, the legal legitimacy is with the protesters and is with the people who are doing everything they can to stop the flow of political and financial and militaristic energy and resources to Israel at this moment. And the fact that they are stating so clearly that, you know, Israel and their allies are stating so clearly that the goal here is to cleanse the region, to displace and dispossess, and then, you know, replace with not only settlers, but real estate and property. The fact that they are able to say so candidly what their goals are, even after this ICJ ruling, just shows how much Gaza has, and, you know, the Gazan people have shown the contradictions and weakness when it comes to these so-called institutions that, ironically, Western states use in order to claim moral authority over the rest of the world.
We're going to go on to a very much related story. From beheaded babies to tortured pregnant women, some of the most gruesome and sadistic stories we were told by the mainstream media about October the 7th didn't actually happen. And a new Al Jazeera documentary goes some way to explaining how these examples of journalistic malpractice, which helped justify a genocidal war, ever made it onto our TV screens in the first place. Al Jazeera make clear that one reason was this. The mainstream media was too keen to believe and amplify the statements of people who weren't always reliable witnesses, and they did so without seeking corroborating evidence. Now, one of the most important of those witnesses was Yossi Landau of ZACA. Now, ZACA is a volunteer group of first responders. We heard a lot about them in the days and weeks after October the 7th. And this part of the documentary begins with him speaking to Sky News at a kibbutz in the days following October the 7th.
You're talking children, two piles of 10 children each were tied to the back, burned to death. This is something behind, this is next level. And
I mean, it's actually indescribable, really. It's indescribable, really.
It's indescribable, and I won't describe everything that I saw.
This account is repeated by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a conversation with President Biden.
They took dozens of children, bound them up, burned them, and executed them.
The list of the dead shows two 12-year-old twins are killed when police and army stormed the house in Be'eri. But there are no other children.
It was an interview we did with Sky Television from Britain. Two piles, we found them in Be'eri. Two piles of 10 children each were tied back to back and burned to death. Now, again, I mean, if we look at the death figures at Be'eri, there are only 10 children that died at Be'eri.
Not children, it's 18-year-old. So we all together, when you look at them and they're burned, you don't know exactly the ages. So you're talking about 18-year-old, 20 years old, and you can't, you just don't look on the spot identification to see the ages or something like that.
Now, I have no doubt that Yossi Landau did witness some awful things in the days after October the 7th, and seeing the charred remains of anyone, whatever their age is, would be incredibly distressing. But this is a man whose stories have been amplified on every major Western network and by senior officials in the US government and by Netanyahu, as you saw there. And he doesn't appear to be a very strong witness. What's worse in this case, and as they explain earlier in the Al Jazeera documentary, is that the most likely reason there even were charred remains at that particular house was because the IDF shelled it. So it seems the IDF shelling a house, killing both hostage takers and hostages, became one about ritualistic burning of multiple children by Hamas. And our media and politicians simply lapped it up. And Al Jazeera had more on Yossi Landau.
It is not the only questionable story that Yossi Landau tells about Kibbutz Be'eri.
We go further. Then we see a woman. She was lying on the floor, a puddle of blood, big puddle of blood. She was a pregnant woman. Her stomach was butchered open. The baby that was connected to the cord was stabbed, and she was shot in the back.
Kibbutz Be'eri has denied this account.
The story of the pregnant woman reported by ZACA is not relevant to Be'eri.
Yossi Landau insists he witnessed this scene at Be'eri.
If you want to see the picture, I have the picture of it.
Are you able to share the photographic evidence with us?
To show you. Yes. Where's my phone? Oh, I'm sorry. I will not put it in front of the camera.
No, that's fine. I'll come and look.
This is the knife they used.
Shot and killed, but...
Over here was the woman.
But that's the imagery after the bodies had been cleared away.
Oh. Yes. This is the baby. This is it.
I'm sorry to be graphic here, but I can't see a baby here.
You can't see the baby because, but this is the picture of the mother.
Okay.
For sure, you know, we didn't think when we over there, we didn't think to camera everything. We didn't have that. This wasn't in our.
The photo shows an unidentifiable piece of charred flesh. The list of the dead contains no victim that fits Yossi Landau's description. On October 7th, two babies die. One is killed when a bullet is fired through a door. The other dies following an emergency cesarean after the mother is shot. Neither is burned or beheaded.
You being someone who, with your own hands, with your own eyes, with your nose, you smelled this, what would you say to that person who is downplaying what took place here?
I wouldn't say anything. I would ask, please give me, he should be together with the Hamas terrorist and he should be killed because he's a part of it.
Wow. So anyone who doubts what Yossi Landau says should be killed, like Hamas, because they are a part of it, right? And you saw that. He says, I've got a picture. It didn't seem to me that, you know, I don't want to use the word lying because I don't want to impute motives to this guy, but it seemed that he could very naturally say things that don't appear to be true, right? So he says, oh, I've got pictures. And he shows a guy a picture and the picture isn't of what he said it was of. Very, very shifty, I mean, you have to say. And I do remember actually watching in the days after October the 7th, Yossi Landau over all of these different channels, including channels which are generally quite sort of critical of the Israeli narrative. So Channel 4 News actually did sort of a bit of a puff piece about him going to those conferences. And they kept sort of just saying as an addendum at the end of each of sort of these reports, Channel 4 News wasn't able to verify anything he said. But that's after doing this incredibly emotive sort of piece where he's saying all this stuff. Time has passed by and it seems like lots of it wasn't true. Now, it is important to say, right, we did speak to the director of that documentary. We spoke to him 2 weeks ago. You can see the link to that interview in the description of this video. Really interesting guy. The reason I bring it up is because he was very clear. They aren't trying to argue that no atrocities happened. They aren't trying to argue that no war crimes happened. In fact, if you watch the documentary, the first 20 minutes or so contains quite a lot of graphic imagery of atrocities which Hamas did commit. So just because, you know, the media spread some untruths does not mean the whole thing was a hoax. But the fact that these, you know, particularly sadistic stories were spread, I think is relevant and important. You know, it's not a detail. Because what Israel wanted to do, I think, in Gaza was a genocidal war, right? And if you want to carry out a genocidal war, you can't be fighting a normal enemy, right? You have to say these are exceptional. These are people who can't be negotiated with. These are rabid. These are barbarians. And to send that image to the world, you know, you always remember Hamas is ISIS. That's what we were constantly told. Hamas is ISIS. And these stories about beheaded babies or sort of decapitated pregnant women, these were what was used to say that this, you know, this wasn't an ordinary attack from militants. Yes, war crimes might have been, we might do war crimes, they might do war crimes. No, when we do war crimes, we do them in a civilized way. That's what Israel say. When they do war crimes, they do them in a barbaric way. This is sort of sadistic terrorism. You cannot negotiate with these people. You just have to completely destroy them because they are the manifestation of pure evil. And those press conferences with the likes of Yossi Landau, that's how they were used. Very explicitly, actually, you sort of saw Netanyahu there on the phone. And the fact that our media sort of went along with it very, very uncritically. And I remember actually when I watched that sort of Channel 4 News documentary, I almost started sending a tweet, you know, like, who is this Yossi Landau guy? But then I thought, well, until I've done some research into it, you know, I'm just going to get attacked. And unless you can sort of, you know, find out what's actually happened with some proper investigative research, you know, it's difficult to find a leg to stand on when you're saying that. So I'm really grateful that Al Jazeera did. Lots else in the documentary. We talked a bit more about it last time when we interviewed the director about the issues of Israeli troops killing some of the civilians that died that day. Again, an issue which was very much, you know, that there was a lack of questioning of that from the mainstream media. We saw lots of images of cars and buildings which looked like they were bombed from above. And then we were told that Hamas did it with, you know, guns, you know, didn't make much sense. And the Al Jazeera documentary shows that there were a significant number of people who seem to have been killed by Israeli troops, either because they thought they were shooting Hamas and shot some Israeli civilians instead, or because they potentially, I think the Israelis deny this, but it seems very, very plausible that they invoked the Hannibal directive, which is to say, it's worse for us for Hamas to take hostages than it is for civilians to die, because if Hamas take hostages, then they have leverage over the Israelis. And if the civilians die, then they don't have leverage. So that was a directive that has been active in the Israeli military. It seems to have been invoked on October the 7th. But again, this is very important. The director of the documentary and the documentary itself never suggests that the majority of Israeli civilians killed that day on October the 7th were killed by the Israelis. And nowhere near the majority, right? So the vast majority of people killed on that day were killed by Hamas militants or other people who went through the fence from Gaza. Dahlia, what did you make of the clips we just showed there from the documentary?
I think that it fits within a pattern that we are seeing. You know, as difficult as it is to watch that, I'm yet again reluctant to place the blame on this one individual. Because the whole point, because what failed here was the professionals. You know, anyone can say anything. It is the job of journalists to, at least to the best of their ability, to decipher the truth from lies, to decide whether or not what someone is saying to them or what lead they have, to evaluate the credibility of that on the basis of journalistic principles. And what we have seen since October is a relentless suspension of normal editorial and journalistic practice in order to bolster one particular narrative of what is going on in the region. And that is why we are seeing this continually happening at different outlets. You know, we saw it in the New York Times, where we saw what looked like could be basically editorial and journalistic malpractice, a story that they ended up backing away from when it comes to the accusations of systematic sexual violence being used on October the 7th. We've seen it in this instance with this one particular witness's story not being treated with the kind of objectivity that you would expect of a journalist. We saw it in the bombing of the Al Ahli hospital, when, you know, everything that we have seen with our eyes, everything that we know about the military capacities of Israel versus the military capacities of Hamas, and yet the narrative, just one narrative put out by the Israeli government, was taken as legitimate and valid enough to basically have us overturn everything that we know to be true about the patterns of violence in this region. And so what is so crucial to understand here is that Palestinians and those who are in solidarity with Palestine are not asking for special treatment. They're not asking for the kind of journalistic malpractice that is giving the benefit of the doubt to Israel to suddenly be flipped and be given the benefit of the doubt to Palestinians. What they're asking is for just normal journalistic reporting, for you to do your job, to abide by the principles that journalism is supposed to abide by. But what we're seeing here is part of a long historical process of racialization that always requires us to think in binaries, particularly when it comes to a colonial encounter such as this one. In order for Palestinians, Arabs to be seen as relentlessly unreliable, to be seen as not human in the way that we are, to be seen as not feeling of pain and loss in the way that everyone else is, to not be taken seriously, to essentially there is no threshold of reliability that Palestinians can reach that enable them to be seen as entitled to internationally enshrined rights, in order to create that debased and dehumanized ideology around who the Palestinians are, you have to, on the flip side, have this understanding of Israelis as being relentlessly reliable and validated. And despite it contravening anything that you know about, you know, legal process or journalistic process, these processes, instead of abiding by them, you have to sort of manipulate them into whatever story will produce the Israelis as the true human beings, the enlightened, the truth tellers, the validated, the legitimate, versus the Palestinians who are unreliable, unvalidated, dehumanized people. And those two things always happen in conjunction with one another, which is why we see the Israeli narrative being always given the benefit of the doubt and the assumption of credibility and truth, regardless of any evidence that might counter that. And yet on the flip side, no matter how much footage the Palestinians provide of what is happening to them, no matter even when they go to the courts, when they go through education, when they go through all of the different means, the legitimate means that you are supposed to go through in order to make a claim on behalf of your people, they are rejected and turned down, even if it requires actually removing the credibility of institutions that up until now have been considered to be the harbingers and the validators of legal process, such as the ICJ or the UN. When the ICJ and the UN come to conclusions that align with Palestinians having basic rights or with Israel doing something wrong, rather than reflecting on why that is the case and saying, wow, these institutions that we endow with a huge amount of credibility is saying this, maybe this means that, you know, on a state level, we need to readjust policy here. It's the opposite. It's in fact the credibility of institutions like the ICJ and of the UN that then get called into question. And so for me, this has always been part of the game of racism. This idea of who can become reliable narrators of themselves, who can be seen to be deserving of sovereignty, of autonomy, who is considered to be rational, who is considered to be credible. That has always been part of the kind of dehumanization versus humanization dynamic of racist colonial thinking. And we're just seeing that playing out right now. And the point is that it's not just because one rogue actor decided to get up and you know, create a particular narrative. It's a systematic failure across many different media outlets at many different points that have happened not only since October, but for decades now.
Let's go on to our next story. Leo Varadkar has resigned as the Irish Taoiseach. The announcement came as a surprise to most and comes from a man who has dominated Irish politics in recent years. In 2017, Varadkar became Ireland's youngest prime minister, a job he held until 2020. After elections in 2020, Varadkar's party, Fine Gael, went into a coalition with Fianna Fáil. Now, as part of that deal, Varadkar would spend 2 years as deputy prime minister before becoming the Taoiseach again in 2022, a role he's had until now. This is how Varadkar announced his resignation.
When I became party leader and Taoiseach back in June 2017, I knew that one part of leadership is knowing when the time has come to pass on the baton to somebody else and then having the courage to do it. That time is now. So I am resigning as president and leader of Fine Gael effective today, and will resign as Taoiseach as soon as my successor is able to take up that office. My reasons for stepping down are both personal and political. I believe this government can be re-elected, and I believe my party, Fine Gael, can gain seats in the next Dáil. Most of all, I believe the re-election of this three-party government would be the right thing for the future of our country, continuing to take us forward, protecting all that's been achieved and building on it. But after careful consideration and some soul searching, I believe that a new Taoiseach and a new leader will be better placed than me to achieve that. On a personal level, I've enjoyed being Taoiseach, leader and a cabinet member since March 2011. I've learned so much about so many things, met so many people who I'd never got to meet, been to places I would never have seen, both home and abroad. And I am deeply grateful for it. And despite the challenges, would wholeheartedly recommend a career in politics to anyone who's considering it. However, politicians are human beings and we have our limitations. We give it everything until we can't anymore, and then we have to move on.
Now, politics aside, I thought it was quite sweet. You've got someone who's been Taoiseach for 5 years, not five consecutive years, so 3 years and then 2 years. And we're sort of saying, it's given me a lot of opportunities, lots of nice experiences, got to travel, got to learn lots. It seemed somewhat sweet. So it came across as fairly humble. I don't know enough about Irish politics to know if that's generally what he's like. The personal reasons for Varadkar resigning remain unclear. He hasn't sort of revealed any details there. As for the political reasons, well, Varadkar's resignation comes 2 weeks after the government was defeated in two referendums held on International Women's Day. Both referendums asked the public whether they wanted to update the Irish constitution, which dates from 1937. I mean, the update would have removed what was considered outdated language. The first vote concerned a clause in the constitution which refers to the family. In the constitution, the family is referred to as being based on marriage. The referendum proposed saying the family is based on marriage or a durable relationship. So an update to make it more inclusive. The other vote concerned the role of women as carers. So in the constitution, as written in 1937, it states, in particular, the state recognizes that by her life within the home, a woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state shall therefore endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home. The referendum asked Irish voters to update that clause to this. The state recognises that the provision of care by members of a family to one another by reason of the bonds that exist among them gives to society a support without which the common good cannot be achieved and shall strive to support such provisions. So you've got a referendum on saying the family, or updating the constitution so that the family isn't just based on marriage, and then another vote to say, you know, carers aren't necessarily women. Both reasonable, I think. Leo Varadkar had backed a yes vote in both the referendums, but both were lost by decisive margins. The referendum on the family, or the family clause in the constitution, lost by 67% to 33%, and the carer amendment was defeated by 74% to 26%. Turnout for both votes was just 44%. Now, this is how Sky News reported on those defeats at the time.
For many years here, commentators and the governments thought that when we eventually got around to having a referendum addressing this outdated language, that it would pass with ease. But this has been a lesson in how not to run a referendum campaign by Leo Varadkar and his government. They simply did not communicate any tangible benefits to a yes vote clearly enough. The language with which they wanted to replace the outdated language was wishy-washy. It was vague. It was criticised by carers. It was criticised by lawyers. And it just did not win over the electorate. The electorate did not see a tangible benefit from voting yes on either of these referendums.
Leo Varadkar's resignation means a new leader will fight the next general election for Fine Gael. The election must be held by March next year at the latest, so the same system we have where the government gets to decide. Sinn Féin want it to take place sooner. Their leader, Mary Lou McDonald, said this in Parliament today.
The decision of who now leads government as Taoiseach must be placed in the hands of the people. The decision of who is in government must be placed in the hands of the people. And today's announcement can have only one conclusion, the calling of a general election. You have stated that it is your time to go and that you are not the person for the job. It's clear that it's time for this entire government to go, to allow the people to have their say and to allow the election of a new government. Fine Gael have been in government for far too long. Ireland had one of the highest rates of home ownership in Europe when Fine Gael came to office in 2011. That has now collapsed. They have failed on housing, on health, and failed to tackle the cost of living. They're out of touch, have run out of ideas, and have run out of time. Another Fine Gael Taoiseach is not what people want. Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Green Party, this government has now run out of steam and run out of road.
There's a good reason why Sinn Féin are keen on bringing forward a general election. They're currently on 28% ahead of Fine Gael, who are on 20%, and Fianna Fáil, who are on 18%. Now, of course, whoever wins is almost certain to need to form a coalition. So coming first doesn't necessarily mean you'll form a government. But Sinn Féin would be in a much stronger position than they currently are in Parliament. To discuss Varadkar's resignation, I spoke earlier to Dan Bin and began by asking him whether Varadkar is resigning because of those failed referendums.
The two referendums on the same day that were held were a significant contributing factor because it indicated at the very least that there was a lack of trust, a lack of confidence in Varadkar himself and in the rest of his government. The option that was being recommended to voters by them simply did not command popular confidence or support. And it's not necessarily because there was overwhelming popular opposition either to what they were proposing, because the turnout in the referendums was about 45%. So significantly lower than the turnout in the referendums on gay marriage and abortion, where in both cases it was well over 60%. If you looked at the substance of what was on the table, even for those who were in favour, even for those who said on balance, this is a good idea, it would be beneficial to make these changes to the wording of the constitution, it was very difficult to say what concrete difference it would make to people's lives. It was very difficult to put your hand on any concrete outcomes that would be possible in the wake of the referendums that were impossible beforehand. And that was a striking contrast with the referendums on gay marriage and abortion, where everybody could see what was at stake and everybody could see what kind of a difference it would make on the day after a yes vote. There seems to be a strong contrast between the image that Varadkar might have outside the country and the way that he's viewed by Irish people in Britain and in other countries. There was an impression that Varadkar was a somewhat liberal figure, possibly related to his personal identity rather than his political stances and track record, because he was gay, openly gay. He was the son of an immigrant. And in that sense, it was easy for newspaper profiles to associate him with the idea of Ireland becoming more socially and culturally liberal. But within Ireland itself, he was perceived accurately as quite an abrasive right-wing politician. He presided over a major housing crisis, which has only continued to get worse based on choices that were made, policy decisions that were made and have continued to be made to rely exclusively on the private sector and rely exclusively on the idea of housing as an asset and rather than housing as a public and social good. The other major issue that came up during Varadkar's time in office was, of course, Brexit, relations with Britain and relations with the European Union. And this is a way also in which the perception abroad, and especially the perception in Britain, is quite mistaken. I think there was a perception in the British Tory press that Varadkar was a strident Irish nationalist and that was responsible for some of the issues that arose over the status of the Irish border and other questions like that. In fact, the image that Varadkar has in Ireland is very different from that. He would be seen as someone who's stridently anti-republican, anti-Sinn Féin, very hostile to the IRA and the legacy of its campaign, as indeed most politicians from his party, Fine Gael, would be.
Let's go straight on to our final story of the day. Alon Levy has been a key cog in Israel's propaganda machine. Since the 7th of October, the Oxford and Cambridge-educated Londoner has frequently appeared on our screens defending Israel's assault on Gaza and calling pro-Palestinian protesters, quote, rape apologists. But it's now been reported that his time as an official Israeli government spokesperson may be coming to an end. Levy has been suspended from duties after angering the UK government. That's reported by the Times of Israel. So what did Levy do to put himself on the wrong side of the UK government? Well, on the 6th of March, Foreign Secretary David Cameron said this: "Meeting with Benny Gantz today, I made clear the steps Israel must take to increase aid into Gaza and the UK's deep concern about the prospect of a military offensive in Rafah. These are tough but necessary conversations." Levy took offence at that tweet and posted a long reply, which included this statement. It is factually incorrect that the flow of aid has not increased. Last week, we had a record 277 trucks. Over the past 2 weeks, there have been nearly 50% more food trucks entering compared with before the war. Israel's crossings have excess capacity, and if the UK wants more aid to enter Gaza, it should send it, and we'll make sure it gets in. And in a tweet that has now been deleted, Levy also said this: I hope you are also aware there are no limits on the entry of food, water, medicine, or shelter equipment into Gaza. And in fact, the crossings have excess capacity. Test us. Send another 100 trucks a day to Kerem Shalom and we'll get them in. Now, those tweets triggered a complaint by officials in the Foreign Office who wrote to Israel's foreign ministry to express their, quote, surprise at Levy's posts and asking whether the remarks reflect the Israeli government's official position. In other words, was the Israeli government really trying to tell us they'd let in 100 trucks a day when there were thousands already queuing outside? Now, the answer was obviously no. But Levy's reply to Cameron isn't the only time he got himself in trouble over telling half-truths to Tory MPs. Responding to a tweet about delays to aid getting into Gaza by Chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Alicia Kearns, Levy said this: Hello, Alicia. Israeli government spokesperson here. Are you aware the Kerem Shalom crossing is currently closed on Saturdays at the request of the UN because there is so much undistributed aid piling up on the other side? The problem isn't aid getting in, it's getting it around. But what Levy didn't seem to know is that Kearns had recently visited the border with Egypt. Now, she replied with this: Thanks for your comments. Please provide evidence of the request by the UN to close on Saturdays. This is not what the UN told us yesterday, nor is it recognized by aid agencies and governments I've spoken to. Now, in response, Levy posted this: Thank you for engaging. This is the Israeli unit responsible for facilitating the transfer of humanitarian aid into Gaza. They will be happy to help you with any questions you have. Right? This is the Israeli unit. He was saying the UN. Kearns wasn't having it. Very happy for COGAT, so that's the Israeli unit, to answer as well. But you made this statement, UN request for no deliveries on Saturday. So I'd be grateful if you can evidence your claims. And then she said, provide the evidence behind your statement or retract and correct it. So she's not accepting this statement from the Israelis. She wanted Levy to justify it with evidence, not just sort of passing on that request. It isn't the only British politician as well that Levy has irritated. So Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be turning on his mouthpiece too. So not just British politicians, also Israeli politicians who are getting annoyed of him. Now, a source in Netanyahu's office told Israeli newspaper Ynet that Levy was, quote, busy from morning to night promoting himself and running an independent agenda. Before the suspension, Levy's media appearances had also been reduced, reportedly at the insistence of Netanyahu's wife, Sarah. That was after she learned that Levy had taken part in anti-government protests over planned judicial reforms. So that's telling there. So on the judicial reform side, he is more liberal than Netanyahu. But when it comes to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, very much on board with the Likud agenda. Of course, I don't imagine you to be feeling too sorry for Levy. But he has come up with an alternative plan. While he might no longer be spinning for a genocidal government, he may be about to take up an altogether different kind of spin. According to Ynet, Levy auditioned for Israel's Dancing with the Stars just last month. Wow. Dahlia, if this guy has lost his job as an official spokesperson, we aren't going to sort of miss him on our screens. It seems like sort of hubris. He got carried away with that. He thought he could sort of play British politicians publicly in the same way that he tries to do that with hosts on television. Obviously, you know, politicians don't like to be lied to on Twitter, right? Somewhat unseemly. But the idea that sort of we're seeing this guy constantly on our TV smugly justifying a genocidal war, and now he's auditioning for Dancing with the Stars. I mean, it's incredibly macabre.
I wouldn't be too quick to kind of claim the death of his political career. I think this is a deeply ambitious man who's got all of the markings of someone who is aiming to get to the top of the political hierarchy. You know, this is a very, he's, you know, very elite private education, going through Oxford and Cambridge. He had, actually, interestingly, he had a brief detour into musical writing. He wrote a musical that about, based on John Rawls's theory of justice, which is like this very sort of dry but quite important political philosophy book for, you know, and he, it was played at the end of a fringe or whatever. So aside from that detour, his career has very much looked, you know, then obviously becoming an Israeli spokesperson for the government. You know, this is someone who is certainly looking to have a very like ambitious political career. And I'm sure he just sees this as a kind of a blip in which sort of internal political, because realistically, I don't think that he would have had this blowback as much from British politicians had Netanyahu not been very willing to let him go, because within his, within domestic Israeli, I mean, everyone in the kind of most in the Israeli state are kind of united in the in terms of the project of ethnic cleansing in Gaza. But when it comes to kind of the domestic particularities of Israeli, you know, there's factions and there's political struggle, and Levy in this moment fell on the wrong side of it. Time will pass and I'm sure he will reemerge. You know, this, when you have that much, when you've been training that much to be a politician, you don't let go as easily, and you realize that time moves quite quickly in the political world. But in terms of this kind of whole fracas, it's beyond Levy himself, even though I don't think he's going anywhere, and I think he's going to be, we're going to see much more of him in the future. It is very exhausting to, in the midst of a campaign that is, as the ICJ has acknowledged, plausibly genocidal in the Gaza Strip, as we are seeing people like Jared Kushner from the cozy ivory towers in the US talking very flippantly about the idea of displacing millions of people from their homes and replacing them with high-value real estate, that we are nitpicking about trucks of humanitarian aid and the way that the weaponization of humanitarian aid and the aim to make this into a logistics conversation about whether or not humanitarian aid is, trucks of humanitarian aid are getting in and can be distributed, when the actual thing that is taking place here is the attempted elimination of Gaza as a Palestinian place inhabited by Palestinian people. It's like the fact that we're, that the conversation is getting deflected into these conversations as if humanitarian, as if first of all, a state that is trying to displace and rid the strip of its inhabitants has any interest in keeping them alive or keeping them healthy. Firstly, that's absurd. And secondly, the idea that if you are being at the receiving end of a genocidal campaign, that having a couple of humanitarian aid trucks coming in is somehow a kind of balance, a balancing act, which we are seeing, you know, Western states that are trying to obfuscate the fact that they are providing political, militaristic, and financial cover for a genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip, are trying to sort of say that we're balancing the scales by trying to get humanitarian aid in. I mean, it's manipulative, it's obfuscating, and it is frankly beside the point. You cannot give bombs with one hand and humanitarian aid with the other. And another reason that it's not only distracting from the magnitude of what the ambition in the Gaza Strip is, but it's also an attempt to portray this as some kind of normal war. And, you know, normal war, I'm not saying that normal war is not brutal, but it's trying to portray this as some kind of conflict that is happening at a meta level that people are just getting caught up in. No, the war is on the people. It's not that people are getting caught in the crossfire. The war is on the people. And the aim is to either by pushing people out because you've made it so inhabitable, or by literally indiscriminate killing, you are trying to eliminate a people. And the fact, and it is a comm strategy to get us into the weeds of this humanitarian truck has managed to get in, or this one hasn't, or the supplies are being stolen by Hamas, or we're uploading videos of us, you know, of Israeli troops flinging boxes into Gaza that just have in Comic Sans written on them, medical supplies and like humanitarian aid. It is all an attempt to obfuscate the much more serious program of elimination that is taking place in the Gaza Strip right now. And frankly, Levy trying to make that the conversation is him doing the job that that, you know, the Israeli state wants him to do. Obviously, he's the spokesperson for it, but that is the ambition that he's trying to fulfill. The problem for him is that he just fell slightly on the wrong side of a domestic dispute. But when it comes to the overall project, I think he is very much has been quite an effective spokesperson for Israel. And I'm sure that his political career and ambitions will resume after this short hiatus. But maybe for now, he can go back to putting on substandard plays about, you know, 19th and 18th and 19th century political philosophy.
Dahlia, let's wrap up there. We're out of time. Thank you for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having me, Michael. My first Navarra Live as a 31-year-old.
Wow. Stop bragging about your young age. Thank you all for tuning in. Although, congratulations on your birthday. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream. For now, you've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.